Matthew 25. We're actually going to back up to the end of chapter 24. But a little bit of background. Yeshua gives in the last part of 24 and all through chapter 25, six parables. All six parables are really about the same thing. They're about his return and about being ready, being prepared. In chapter 24, he talks about, and I'm going to try to talk while I change a setting here on my iPad that I should have done earlier so it won't go off. Let's see. I can't talk and do it at the same time, so let me just do it right here. There we go. Done. All right. Where was I? He gives six parables about his return. Now, there are very few things where Yeshua gives so much time and attention to than this. And the emphasis is always, be ready, be ready, be ready, be ready. I'm coming when you don't expect me. Be ready. The first parable in chapter 24 is about the fig tree in verses 32 to 35. Then he talks about the night thief. And this is a theme you find throughout the New Testament writings, about him coming like a thief in the night. And back in the first century, a thief wasn't a cat burglar. A thief came in loud and fast and with a shock to just kind of petrify and paralyze the people he was coming to steal from. It wasn't sneaking in and sneaking back out. They would come in on horseback or riding in and yelling and just paralyzing people with fear, taking what they want and then running away. And he says that's the way he's going to return. So we're mostly interested this morning in the final four parables. And here's a little bit of an outline for you to keep in your minds as we go through these. In chapter 24, verses 45 to 51, he gives the parable of the absent landowner, landholder. And let's go ahead and just read that now. And I'm going to go ahead and read it out of my New American Standard. Chapter 24, starting verse 45. Who then is the faithful and sensible servant whom his master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time. Now notice this evil servant still refers to the master as my master. Is that two-faced or what? He's an evil servant, but he still refers to God as his master. My master is not coming for a long time. And he begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and in an hour which he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. That cut him in pieces really means to flog him. I mean, if he's cut in two or cut into pieces, there's not much to assign with the hypocrites. It is a term that refers to being flogged, because when a person was flogged, it would lay open the flesh on their backs. So he'd be flogged, and then his place would be assigned to the hypocrites. In that place, there will be weeping, which is a picture of sadness and sorrow, and gnashing of teeth, which is always a picture of anger. Now, the next two parables are so well known, the parables of the 10 virgins and of the talents. But each of these parables contains elements of this first one. And we're going to see that in just a moment. And these three parables together all have to do with what you might call the insiders, or with God's household. I'm just going to put insiders here. But these are people with knowledge, people who have some kind of a relationship with the master, with the bridegroom. But then the fourth parable that finishes chapter 25 is about the sheep of the goats. Sheep and the goats, these are people who are outsiders. They have no relationship with the master. They don't know God. They don't know his word. They don't know anything about him. In fact, when they are judged, they have no idea why they're even getting the reward or the punishment they're getting. They're completely oblivious to truth. It's all news to them when judgment comes along. So what we're going to do, I want to go back to the absent landholder, bring out a few insights about that, and then show how that relates to the 10 virgins and the parable of the talents. And then we'll finish up with this fourth parable about the sheep and the goats. Now, it says this servant is an evil servant. What are the signs of an evil servant? Two things. He abuses his fellow workers. And second, he eats and drinks with drunkards. This tells me that this person finds his closest fellowship outside the household of God, outside the household of the master. How does he treat his fellow servants, people he used to be brothers with? He abuses them. He beats them is the word that's used. Well, how do we do that? We do it mostly with our mouths, with our criticisms, with our pride, with our silence. But there are all kinds of ways we can abuse one another for whatever reasons. And what does it mean to eat and drink with drunkards? You might think, well, I don't eat and drink with drunkards. Well, do you find fellowship with people who are driven by their own appetites, whatever those appetites are? When you see the word drunkard in Scripture, don't just think about alcohol. A drunkard refers to anyone who operates under the influence of some foreign thing, whether it's a physical substance, a theology, an idea, some deception. It could be anything. Where do you find your fellowship? And I have found that people generally are guilty of both or neither. But these go as a pair. And don't be surprised if you find times in your own life you find yourself guilty of doing both of these things. I hope you repent. I know I've been guilty of both of these, and they always come as a pair. It seems when I begin to complain and abuse the people I'm around, just kind of get irritated with them, then I find my comfort outside the household of God. I go to entertainment and to books and to people who I really don't have much in common with spiritually. And I find my fellowship with them. But when I repent of that, then all of a sudden, I start treating my brothers and sisters with love, and I don't look for my fellowship outside of my family. Have you noticed it? Can you identify with what I'm saying? You'd be very careful of this. Because we can go back and forth from being a good servant to sometimes being an evil servant and repenting and going back. And if you find yourself in a place where you find yourself with a critical spirit towards your brothers and sisters, and then you seem to find your comfort with those people outside the house of God, then this parable is about you, and you need to be warned. And then what is the outcome of this servant? Well, he'll be cut up. He'll be flogged. And you should read Luke 12, verses 47 and 48, where it says, "And that servant who knew his master's will, but did not get ready or act according to his will receive a severe beating." So the one who's beating his fellows receives a beating. But the one who did not know and did what deserved a beating will receive a light beating, because he acted ignorantly. "Everyone to whom much was given, of him much will be required. And from him to whom they entrusted much, they will demand the more." So we see that those who are abusive receive abuse. And we see that those who eat and drink with drunkards have their place assigned with the hypocrites. And if you want to know what Yeshua thinks of hypocrites, just back up a chapter to chapter 23. I mean, here's love incarnate speaking in a way that seems out of character. It's not. But woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. And he just lays them open. He gives them a verbal flogging because there's nothing left of them. There's nothing left to appeal to in them. They become so hardened in their hearts that there's nothing to lose. Just let them know. And I think for one who's truly a hypocrite, the only thing left for them is to lovingly tell them, "You're really a hypocrite. You're a fake." And there's a time when that sometimes is necessary. I saw a t-shirt last week, and it said, the next time you ask yourself, what would Jesus do? Realize that making a whip, turning over tables, and driving people out is a possible option. But that should be a last resort, not a first. Now, this parable starts out with a question. It asks this question: who is the faithful and wise servant? Who is the faithful and wise servant whom his master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? Well, that servant is the Messiah, because that's a quote from Psalm 145 and verse 15, I believe. Psalm 145, 15. It says, the eyes of all look to you, and you give them their food in due season. So the question is, who is the good servant? Who's the faithful and wise servant whom, when his master comes, finds him giving the servants food in due season? That is the Messiah. But there's a second answer. The second answer is you and me. Yeshua didn't come and do work so we don't have to do any. He came and did work so we could see how works are to be done. He came as the light of the world to show us what that looks like. And then he says, you're lights of the world. Let your light so shine among men they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. He came and gave up his life and died so that we don't have to. Not so that we wouldn't have to, but so that, as George MacDonald says, so that our death could look like his. You understand? He came to show us the way. He came and filled the Torah and lived it out so we could see how to live it out. We also should be giving God's servants their food, their sustenance at the right times. This is the job number one for us. I think too many times we put evangelizing the lost before loving the saved. Because Yeshua says, by this, all men will know that you're my disciples. Because you're out crossing land and sea to make converts? No. But by your love one for another. I think sometimes if you really want to be loved by the church, don't become a believer and don't join. They'll always love you. They'll be patient with you and merciful. They'll do everything to win you over. They'll just lay down their lives for you. Once you join, it's like, okay, get in line here. Let's go find another one. Let's go hook another one. Love number one. The number one people we should love are the brothers and sisters. And then people will be flocking in when they ask, I see such love among you people. Now, of course, I'm preaching to the choir because I really do see love here at Beth Tikkun. I'm always bragging about you. And, you really do honor to God's commandment, to Messiah's commandment to love one another. I see it happening here all the time. Don't stop. Don't let up. Don't become weary in well-doing. Keep loving each other. And don't ever relax that. And when the people on the outside see that kind of love, they're going to be asking about it. You understand? So we should be feeding one another. That means strengthening one another, sustaining one another, praying for one another, encouraging one another. You know, when Yeshua asked Peter, Peter, you love me? Yes, you know I love you. Feed my sheep. That's the work Messiah does. That's the work he gives us to do. Feed the sheep. Now, before I get completely off on a rabbi trail, let's get back on track. He says, who is the faithful and wise servant? I switched these back. So forget the, those don't go there. All right? They should be down here instead. I will fix that before I put this on the internet. Faithful, the word faithful is the word pistos in Greek. And in the parable of the talents, what does he say to the one who vested the talent? He says, well done, good and pistos servant, faithful servant. And who is the wise servant? The word there for wise is the word thronimos. And that's used of the wise virgins. So these two words, get it now, Who is the faithful and wise servant? To answer that question, Yeshua provides two parables. One to teach us who the wise servant is, that's the parable of the 10 virgins. And to teach us who the faithful servant is, and he gives the parable of the talents to teach that. Do you understand the connection now? So the first parable there at the end of chapter 24 is then opened up into a menorah pattern in chapter 25. Who is the faithful and wise servant? Let me give you two parables. The first one's going to illustrate what a wise servant is. And then the next parable to illustrate what a faithful servant is. Now, I might ask, you know, because even I got goofed up on the arrows, why doesn't he give the talent parable first and the wise parable second, so everything just lines up neatly? I think it's Yeshua's way of showing that these are mixed together. They're inseparable, and they're interchangeable because they go together as one. So let's read the parable of the 10 virgins. And it begins in chapter 25 and verse 1. I'll make a few comments as we go through. And hopefully we can look at this in a way maybe we've never quite looked at it before. It says, "Then the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom." Now, when you look at commentaries, there'll be all kinds of explanations about what's going on. But to be perfectly honest, nobody really knows. I found one stray comment by somebody, I'm not even sure if it's true, where he said that a friend of his years ago went to Israel and they were driving along and he asked the taxi driver, "Who are these 10 women walking along here with lights?" And he says, "Oh, they're going to a wedding party." And it sounded a little iffy, it sounded a little shaky. But most commentaries will say we don't really know what was going on culturally with this. I'll give you my opinion. My opinion is this. I think Messiah is trying to teach two things here. I think the bridegroom is marrying all 10. But that never took place in the first century. He didn't have a wedding where he married 10 people at one time. You know, that just didn't wash. But he's illustrating the fact that the bride of Messiah is made up of a collective. Okay? And he's trying to teach that. He's trying to put that across, so he has these 10 virgins, these 10 bridesmaids, these 10 fiancés coming. He doesn't quite put it that way, that he's marrying all 10, but I think he's letting our imaginations play out because he's making a picture of Messiah and his collective bride, which is made up of the believers. All right? I think that's what's going on. But all that to say, don't let it trouble you if you can't quite find the exact cultural equivalent of what's happening here in this parable. That's not the important thing. The important thing is to see what he's trying to illustrate through this parable. He says, 5 of them were foolish, and 5 were prudent or wise. They were thronimos. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them. Now, look at verse 4 now. But the prudent took oil in flasks, that's number one, along with the lamps, that's secondary. I want you to think about something for a moment. Let me ask you a question. Let's say someone says, "No, you're going to have to go out into the dark and spend the night outside. And here I've got a clay lamp, and here I've got a flask of oil. You can take one or the other, but you can't take both. Which one would you take?" You take the flask of oil. Because you don't really need the lamp. You can take anything that burns, dip it in the oil and light it, and it'll give you light. The lamp is just a vessel that makes burning a wick easier. But you can use anything. But these foolish ladies, they took lamps. And in the daytime, they looked wise. Oh, look, they're all prepared for the night. But they looked wise only until the sun went down. When the sun went down, they were exposed as being foolish. You know, our lamps can be our religion. Our lamps can be our theology. And you can have the most beautiful lamp in the world, so much more posh and attractive and expensive than anyone else's. But when the lights go down, when the lights go out, and we are in darkness, and you know, we all have this sense we've talked about before of entering a time in this world that's very dark. Nobody cares how fancy your lamp is. The only thing that matters, do you have something to put in it? Do you have oil? And what is oil? Oil is something that takes great time to create. And it requires crushing. It requires fruitfulness. It requires crushing. The oil in your life represents God's Spirit in your life. It represents your good works. It represents your walk with God, your experiences, and the things you've went through that have squeezed you and crushed you and now has brought something valuable and precious. So the foolish and wise all looked wise until the lights went out. Now while the bridegroom was delaying, they all got drowsy and began to sleep. But at midnight there was a shout, "Behold, the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. The foolish said to the prudent, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the prudent answered, "No, there will be not be enough for us and you too." Now notice the wise virgins are not called mean virgins, because they wouldn't share. They're called wise. There's something about your life and your experiences you simply cannot give to someone else. You can give them the light that comes from it, but the essence, the substance itself, that walk that you've experienced with God over the years, that's something you can't give away. The light it creates is for everyone, but the source of that is something that's only yours and yours alone. "So go instead to the dealers and buy some for yourselves." And while they were going away to make the purchase, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with them to the wedding feast, and the door was shut. Later, the other virgins also came, saying, "Lord, Lord, open up for us." Now notice, like in the first parable, they still call him their Lord, still call him their master. But what does he say back? He answered, "Truly, I say to you, I don't know you." Now, Yeshua had said something similar to this back in Matthew 7, when he tells certain ones, "Depart from me, you workers of iniquity," or you Torahless ones, I never knew you." He's not mean. Doesn't say that to these. He says, "I don't know you." What does that mean? How could Messiah not know someone? Well, the word "know" in Hebrew doesn't mean just to have intellectual information. It means to be one with. And whenever you come to one of these passages where the Messiah says, "Depart, I don't know you," there's a passage that should always pop in your mind. It's 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 3. And it's a short little verse, but it enlightens this passage. It says, "If anyone loves God, he is known by God." If anyone loves God, he's known by God. So what happens when God says, or the Messiah says, "I don't know you"? It means you don't love me. We've never walked together. You've never spent time with me. We are not one. In Hebraic thought, to know something is to be one with something. In English, you might say, "Yeah, I know how to change oil on a car." But in Hebrew, you can't say that unless you've actually done it and proven you can do it. Unless your ability and your knowledge are one, you don't really know it. If you can't do it, you don't know it. If you can't explain it, you don't know it. You follow? To know something means the knowledge and the knower are one. In fact, when a husband and a wife come together physically, it says that they are having knowledge of each other. Abraham knew his wife, right? Adam knew his wife. It means they become one. Whenever you see the word "know" in a Hebraic context, it means to be one. To know God doesn't mean you know about him. It means you know him. You're one with him. And whoever loves God is known by him. He's one with God. You follow? So when he says, I don't know you, he doesn't say, you look familiar. I think I recognize the voice. He's saying, we never had anything together. What are you doing? We don't know each other. We're not one. You never loved me. Sometimes I wonder if the foolish virgins are simply imitating the wise. Oh, they're wise. Look, they've got lamps. We've got lamps. And the foolish had some oil in the lamps, but they didn't have enough to get them through the night. And I think sometimes, instead of really hitching our wagon to God himself, truly knowing him, having fellowship with him, instead of us as sheep following the shepherd, I think sometimes we as sheep follow other sheep. We need to know him. And you know, I think there are a lot of people who are believers, who believe in God. They believe truths about him, but they've never really contacted him. They don't really, truly know him. You can read about some historical figure. Say, I know all about him. Well, do you know him? Well, no, we never really met. But in Hebraic thought, to know God means you've connected with him. You've experienced him. You have conversation together. There's back and forth. You may argue at him. But there's definitely this connection, just like you have with others. That's something we must have if we're truly to be his people. If we're going to be wise. If we're going to be thronomos and not be foolish. Okay, if you're visiting, you're allowed to ask questions or comments. Adam, thank you for breaking the ice. Let's get a microphone over to Adam so he can share. I know there's some microphones floating around somewhere. Ah, there we go. Okay. There we are. All right.
Enter this parable to, I guess, the traditions you talked about previously with that whole betrothal.
Yes.
That, you know, the man would come and say, I'm going to go establish a house. You would leave and come back. I would assume that the woman were excited for the marriage she would be waiting for.
Yes.
She would, you know, return and they'd be like, oh, she went on vacation. She'd be back in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
You know, so if you were to get there and the bride was gone, or much less, you were to get there, they'd say, well, she's out without, and then she comes back in. Later that night, you become curious and you wonder who is this person.
Right.
So I part of me, at least, anchored it back to the tradition of engagement. I could see that these ladies who took the wine, they were excited, they were anticipating their lives to be revolved around it. They were sort of foolish, and I almost wondered, you know, well, we've got a lamp that's got to be good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like you prompt a thought. It's like the wise virgins, their focus is on the bridegroom. The foolish virgins, their focus seemed to be on the wise virgins. Oh, we want to be like them. You know, and I think what you're saying is very true. Absolutely. Anyone else have something, an insight maybe that struck you as we're going through this parable? Yes, Bob. Oh, let's get a microphone over. There we go.
I don't know if this is an accurate connection or not, but just thinking about what took place earlier in the service. Mm-hmm. We had a bat mitzvah today, and in Caitlin's life, she's been receiving teaching and training and the oil, so to speak.
Yes.
But now, the responsibility goes to her.
Yeah.
And it's up to her to maintain that oil in her life, so to speak.
That's an excellent insight. That's a great, great example. Thank you. Yes, and back here is Rob, correct?
That's Ben.
Ben. I'll never get it right, Ben. I'm sorry.
So if you find yourself in the wrong camp, what's the pathway to the right camp? So if you're following the wise virgins and whatnot. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I think the first, that's a great question. I think the first step to realize you're foolish. And ego is the thing that will blind us to ever asking that question or hearing the answer. And when I think of the story where Yeshua talks about the publican and the Pharisee. The Pharisee was a hypocrite. He couldn't see it. But the publican, this what you might call the lowlife, God be merciful to me, a sinner. Lord, I'm a mess. I need your help. And right away, he's beginning to connect with God in a way this publican has never experienced. Yeah, I think that's step number one. Yeah, you know, the humility is the beginning of wisdom. And fear of God is also called the beginning of wisdom. And I think to develop a healthy humility and a healthy fear of God, you're on your way. But without those two things, you can study a lot of theology, quote a lot of Proverbs, and still be very foolish. Yes, and Abby, here comes the microphone.
How do you actually know if you know God? Because you said you, by having conversations, mm-hmm. What if you don't actually, what if it's just a one-time thing?
That's a wonderful question.
Can you actually measure it?
Yeah. Okay. Yes. There are several things God gives us as indicators. One of those is mentioned by people's fruits. You know, what are the fruits of a person's life? But I'm thinking of 1 John and chapter 2, verse 3. By this we know that we have come to know him. That's the question you have, right? How do we know that we know him? By this we know that we've come to know him if we keep. That means to guard his commandments. The one who says, I have come to know him, and does not keep his commandments, he's a liar. This is a strong term. I think it means he's deceived. He's strongly deceived. The truth's not in him. But whoever keeps his word. Now notice he says commandments the first time, then he says the word. The commandments are the black and white print on the page, but the word is the spiritual essence that lies behind those commandments. But whoever keeps his word, in him the love of God has truly been perfected. By this we know that we are in him. The one who says he abides in him ought himself to walk in the same manner as he walked. Beloved, I'm not writing a new commandment to you, but an old commandment which you have had from the beginning. The old commandment is the word which you have heard. Go back to the Torah, John is saying. The old word. Go back to the ancient paths, Jeremiah says in chapter 6. And, you know, we read last time we were together, 2 weeks ago. And Yeshua says, because Torahlessness will increase, the love of many will grow cold. There's something about just investing our hearts and minds in the Torah. And conscientiously building his word into our lives and doing it, not just being here that deceives us, but doing his word. There's something about that makes us love him more. Just makes us love him more. I mean, I loved Robin like crazy before we got married and after he got married. But over the years, as I learned the things that please her, I find that by doing the things I know pleases her, somehow elevates my love for her even more. Doesn't diminish it. And so when you love someone, you want to please them. So to say I love God, but you're not looking to please him, something's wrong. Something's really wrong. So you ask a great question. This is how we know him. How can we know him if we're not investing our minds in his message to us? This is how we know God, through the message he gives us. His revelation of himself. Yeah. All right. Great questions. I just wish the answers were half as good as the questions. These are great. Priscilla, yes. Now we need a microphone. Over for Priscilla.
If the oil in the vessels of the wise virgins was something that could not be shared, why did the foolish ones bother asking?
Because they were foolish.
Well, but I mean, if our life experiences cannot be shared.
We can tell people about our life. Our life experiences make us who we are. My life is my life. Your life is yours. But because one person has invested their life in following God. As a result of that, they've been pruned. They've grown. They produce fruit. They've been changed. That's something I can't give you. That's my story. You have to develop your own story with God. Your story must be yours. Absolutely, I can tell you. But it's still my story I'm telling you. But I say, now tell me your story. You don't have one. You see? So, yeah. But that's a good question. All right. Should we move on? Okay. Let's go on to the next parable. So, this first parable about the 10 virgins is given an illustration of what it means to be wise, to be a wise servant. The next parable, the parable of the 10 talents, is to teach us about what it means to be a faithful servant. So, let's pick it up in chapter 25, verse 14. For it is just like a man about to go on a journey who called his own servants and entrusted his possessions to them. To one he gave 5 talents. The Hebrew word is kikorim. In Greek, it's something like talentos. So we get our English word talent, like that person's very talented. We get it from the King James Bible, and it's just kind of stuck. Okay, so the word talent is actually a weight. It's an incredible amount of money. Now, just to let you know, over in Luke 19, there is another parable about a man who gives money to some servants, and he goes away, and they're expected to invest it and so on. But it's a different parable. There's some similarities, but it's a completely different parable with a different thrust. So you could read the parable in chapter in Luke 19, but you'll see it's very, very different from this one. Some similarities, yes, but it's a different context, a different thrust. This is an incredible amount of money. They say a talent of gold is about 15 years worth of salary. So take what you make in a year, multiply it by 15, then add some more on. Okay? So to one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his own ability. And he went on his journey. You notice something missing? What's missing from the verse? He just gave him money and left. No instructions as what to do with it. None, zero, zilch, nada. Not a single word as to what to do. He just gives it to them. Don't you think they knew what they're supposed to do with it? It says, verse 16, immediately, the one who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them and gained 5 more talents. So he doubles his money. Verse 17, in the same manner, the one who had received the 2 talents gained 2 more. But he who received the 1 talent went away and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. Now you notice that the master knew these servants very well. We're going to find out that this third servant didn't know his master very well. But the master knew them because it says back in verse 15, he gave to them according to each one's ability. So the one with the 5 talents had the most ability. The one with the 1 talent had the least. And we're going to talk about, in just a moment, as we get to the end, what determines how much ability you have? What determines that? Because after all, if God is our creator, he's the one who gives us the degree of ability, correct? But I think there's a way for you to increase the ability you have. Well, let's move on. Verse 19. Now, after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. Now, in the Greek, this is present tense. The master of those slaves comes and settles accounts with them. The one who had received the 5 talents came up and brought 5 more talents, saying, Master, you entrusted 5 talents to me. See, I have gained 5 more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and pistos. There's that word, faithful. This is the parable to illustrate what faithfulness looks like. Good and faithful servant, you were faithful with a few things, but I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. Also, the one who had received the 2 talents came up and said, Master, you entrusted 2 talents to me. See, I have gained 2 more talents. His master said to him, the exact same message, same words. Well done, good and faithful servant. You are faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And then we come to the third servant. And the one also who had received the 1 talent came up and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, and gathering where you scattered nothing. All right, now is this true? It says, I know you to be like this. The question is, apply this to God. Is God a hard man who reaps where he doesn't sow, gathers where he didn't spread anything out? The very fact you're having trouble answering the question shows there's some things about God you don't understand. Now, I had a week to wrestle with this to kind of get my own head straight. But if I had been sitting out there right now listening to me, I'd have been like, yeah, is God hard? Let's look at some examples of where this word hard is used. The word in Greek is the word skleros. And it's translated different ways. John 6:60. When many of his disciples heard it, they said, this is a skleros saying. This is a hard saying. Who can listen to it? What's another word you could use there? Difficult, complicated, deep. Something that's not easily understood. Acts 26:14. God speaks to Paul, says it is hard for you to kick against the goads. In other words, it's difficult. It's tough. James 3:4, look at the ships also, though they are so large, are driven by strong winds. It's the exact same word, strong. Jude 1:15, the harsh things that ungodly sinners have spoken against them. It's translated harsh. All the same word. Exact same word. Now, honestly, is God difficult to understand? Is he difficult to resist, like in 26:14? Is he strong? And can he be harsh? Yes. All of them are true of God, right? The problem is, this is half the story. And remember the saying, a half truth is a whole lie. Because not only can God be very difficult to understand, he has done so many things to make himself accessible to us so we can know him and know him deeply. He's humble and lowly. Is he hard to resist? Absolutely. And yet at the same time, he tolerates so many things in our lives. He tolerates so much sin in our lives. Not forever, but for a time, to give us time to repent. And there are so many times he yields to us. He lets us have our way so we can learn it's not the smartest way in the world. He's strong, but he's also meek. Again, yielding. You know, any God who could send the deliverer in the form of a helpless baby born in a stable, that speaks volumes about this God. And can it be harsh? Absolutely. But can he be gentle? Oh my goodness. Look how he treats the woman at the well. Look how he treated tax collectors and sinners. With such great gentleness and patience and love. So are these true? Yes. But there's also an opposite. You know, there's one place, I don't know the references, but there's one place in Paul's writings where he says, behold the goodness of God. And another place says, behold the harshness of God. Okay? You have a menorah, don't you? A left and a right. 2 things that balance out. So this servant says, oh, I know you to be a hard man. Of course, then the master comes back and says, well, if you knew this, why didn't you do something? And here's the thing. He says, the servant says, I know that you, how does he put it? I know that you reap where you have not sown and you gather where you've not scattered. Now, that's a lie. Now that part's just dead wrong. The reason we have the principle of sowing and reaping in this world, whether it's in finances or in agriculture or in anything else, the reason that principle is a law of nature is because it's something that reflects God's ways. And you'll always see God sowing all through the scriptures. All the time, he's doing some little thing here and some little thing there, and then it blossoms and grows into some big thing. By all means, God operates in this world by the principle of sowing and reaping, of planting a seed and allowing it to grow and bear fruit all the time. But you know what we do? We get in our heads this idea, oh, God just snaps his fingers and it happens. Poof, there it is. And he can. But he chooses to operate in a way of sowing and reaping. He chooses to operate a way that takes time. And I think when we start living a life where we just pray and expect God to snap his fingers and make things happen, we're really missing who he is. We somehow expect God to not play by the rules he has established for us. But God operates within the systems he has established. And when we pray, I believe immediately God begins to sow seeds. And we continue to pray. And seeds grow down into the dark before they ever break the surface into the light. We begin to pray, things begin to happen in the unseen world, the unseen realm, and we are completely oblivious. But you can trust that God's beginning to sow. But time and patience, and eventually it blossoms. Eventually it bears fruit. Eventually you've got to, wait a minute, there it is. There's the answer. That's how our God works. But this servant somehow missed out on that fact. Now, Tony, you've been very patient, but you had your hand up, so go right ahead.
This parable is very difficult to really understand, because it says he gave the talents to their ability. Mm-hmm. Now, and then why did he give 5, 2, and 1? Isn't it more or less saying, well, I know this one's not going to do nothing with it, so I'm only going to give him 1. Yes. Hasn't he already prejudged? Hasn't he said, I know you're not going to do anything? Was the money he gave 2 surprising? Did it surprise him because he doubled the amount? Well, to me, it really is a very difficult parable for me to grasp, because the states that he gave to them as their ability. So he was saying, I don't know. It's tough for me to grasp what I'm supposed to get out of this.
Well, here's the other thing that's missing from the parable. Okay? And you put your finger right on it. When the one with the 5 doubles it into 10, the one with the 2 doubles it into 4, what did they do with them then? What did they do with them? Gave them back, right? Doesn't say that. Look, it's not there. It's not there. They didn't give them back. Now we can assume they did, but it doesn't say. And since it doesn't say, it's almost as if God's saying, all right, you've got 10. What are you going to do with those 10? You've now got 4. What are you going to do with those 4? And the one with 1 could have doubled it to 2. And then he would have been in the same position as the second servant was at the beginning of the story. He could have become one of these with great ability. And normally you wait to the end of the teaching to really give the bottom line of what the teaching's all about. I'll give it to you right now in the middle. The greatest sin that's being illustrated in all three of these parables is a sin of passivity. That was the problem with the wicked servant. That was the problem with the foolish virgins. That's the problem with this servant here who buried his talent in the ground. Passivity. Being passive. Just thinking, I've got what I need. It's okay. He's not coming back for a long time. I might as well enjoy it. Kind of go along for the ride. Passivity. Being passive. A horrible sin. Terrible sin. And and you're going to see that the master is very angry with this servant. The bridegroom wasn't all that angry with the foolish virgins. They were just foolish. But it doesn't say this man was foolish. It says he was wicked and lazy. Extremely passive. He had information, but he just didn't do anything with it. I see some hands. I think Brian's hand was up first, or Mims. Okay.
Well, it just occurred to me, would it not amount to heaping more condemnation on that lazy servant had the master, in fact, given him more? I'm thinking Luke 12:48, to whom much has been given, much shall be required.
Yeah.
And so for the Lord of that servant to have given him more, how much more would it have been his condemnation?
Yeah. Oh, yes, right.
And then I'm thinking also Matthew chapter 13, verse 12, where Yeshua says, for whoever has, to him shall be given, and he shall have more abundance.
Yeah.
But whoever has not, from him shall be taken away, even though he has.
Yep.
There's a principle there that I think underlies everything we're talking about here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right here coming up in a few verses, that passage, yeah. And I think Mary Jo is next. And then I see Adam's hand up, but you know what? We're going to move on because I'm watching the hands on the clock, and they're all sticking straight up, too. And so, Mary Jo, go ahead.
Okay. I just have a comment. I'm thinking about this as looking at the attitude of our soul.
Yeah.
And this servant with the one talent was given what he could handle because I wrote down. And I take this from my own experience. There's self-loathing, narcissistic, he's fearful, which means he's angry, he's not grateful to God, and that got to get me.
Yeah.
And God is only going to give him a little bit. I think what God wants is to, you know, you go to the next page and it talks about, you know, he says, you could have put this in the bank.
Yeah.
And you could have done something with it. And I say, you know, I had all this in my life years ago, and I wanted to stop it. With everything that happens in our life, we have we have the opportunity to say, God, I want you in my life or I don't want you in my life. And I took the opportunity to say, God, I want you in my life. I don't know how you're going to get me out of this, but I want out of this. I don't want to live like this anymore. And over the years, he has taken me out.
Yes.
And it's almost like I put my trust in the bank. I put my trust in God and said, I don't know how. I wasn't miraculously healed. He showed me through his words, through people, how to, you know, live for him.
Yes.
And this man does not feel, it's a woman, I don't think, does not feel that he's lovable. Yeah. You know, they're just... He just went in and caved in.
Yeah.
And so that's it.
Oh, well, thank you. That's wise and insightful. Thank you for sharing that. And, you know, I'm not even going to look up to see whose hands are up now because we have so much to cover. That's so important for us to get through that, for us to really grasp some of the other insights, some of the things here that Messiah is saying. So let's see what the master says to him. First of all, verse 25. The servant says, you know, he said, I know you're a hard man. You reap or you don't sow. Verse 25, I was afraid. I went away and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours. Now he's given his back. Here it is. But his master answered and said to him, you wicked, lazy servant. You knew that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I scattered. That's what you thought? Then you ought to put the money in the bank. Let somebody else do the work. And on my arrival, I have received my money back with interest. Therefore, take away the talent from him. Give to the one who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more shall be given. And he will have an abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. Throw out the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Here are the errors of the faithless servant. First of all, he didn't know his master. And if you don't know God, you're not going to know how to live your life and how to invest the things God's given you. You're simply not going to know how to do that. Second, he committed the sin of fear. And fear is a sin. Don't ever think it's not. You think it's just an emotion? Well, somebody's dangling you by one ankle over a into a skyscraper. Yeah, I get that. But the fear of living for the future and stepping out, that's called a sin. I can't tell you how many times people come to me for counsel. I found this real simple counseling method. They're trying to figure out what to do. And they're, well, I'm kind of afraid of this, I'm concerned about this, I'm worried about that. And then I just ask them, okay, pretend for a second you had no fear. You're the most courageous man on earth. What would you do then? And you know what? They always give me those wise, insightful, godly counsel. And I said, all right then, do that. Do that. All they're coming up to really is saying, I'm just afraid. I know what to do, but I'm afraid to do it. Well, don't be afraid. Just do it anyway. What's the worst going to happen? You'll die. All right, you're going to die anyway, so might as well die doing something worthwhile. Sorry. He refused to make a decision. That's this passivity. And here's the girl thing. What do the wise and the foolish virgins do? They talk to each other, right? What do these guys do? He doesn't say squat. All they had to do is ask, hey, you with the five, what are you going to do with yours? Help me out here. But he didn't. He just clammed up, dug a hole, and buried it. Oh, well. Now, I want to take these two parables again, the virgins and the talents. I want you to see the similarities. First of all, both groups awaited someone's return. Both groups were given time to prepare. And if you didn't know, 5 + 5 does equal 10. But you see that in both parables. You have 5 foolish virgins, 5 wise virgins, total 10 virgins. You have a man who's given 5 talents, he makes 5 more, 5 + 5 = 10. See the themes? Yeshua is planting these clues to tell us these stories are two halves of the same thing. In both parables, there's some who enter and some left out. The wise virgins, they go into the wedding feast, it says the door is shut. And the others stay outside. Here the master tells the two servants, enter into the joy of the Lord. But with the other ones cast out into what? Outer darkness. We see light and darkness in both. But we also in both see there are no excuses. None. Being afraid, not an excuse. Not knowing your master, sorry, not an excuse either. Not making a decision, that's not an excuse. Not having oil in your lamp, no excuse. No excuses. It's passivity. But here are the key differences. To the foolish virgin, he says, I never knew you. We're not one. We didn't invest in knowing me. But the wicked and lazy servant, he claimed to know his master. He didn't, but he thought he did. And that really got him in trouble. And he's called wicked and lazy. You can feel the anger of the master towards this wicked and lazy servant. With the women, as I mentioned, there's interaction between them. With the men, we don't see any interaction. In the first parable, we see 10 virgins become 5. But in the second parable, we see 5 talents become 10. And the first parable is about women. Second parable is about men. And that's a very key thing. Because you see, men and women in Hebraic thought don't just represent 2 genders, 2 biological necessities to reproduce children. We see that in men and women, masculinity and femininity are principles. And femininity is always about hiddenness and concealment and internality. Because the problem with the virgins, the foolish virgins, they took the lamp, but they didn't have the internals. That's made them foolish. The wise ones, they get the internals as well. And with the wicked servant, he had something that he was to take into the world and invest and make it grow. What does he do? Instead of making that external the way the male is supposed to do, he buries a hole, digs a hole and buries it, hides it away, keeps it hidden, internal. You know, even the way God made bodies. A man's organs are external, but a woman's organs are internal. And one rabbi points out that when Sabbath comes, the woman lights the candles to bring light into the home. But at Hanukkah, the man lights the candles and the menorah is put in the window to send light out into the world. And we can go on and on and on and on and on. But femininity is about receiving and nurturing internally, quietly, patiently, and allowing something to grow. Masculinity is about being external, about going out. And when you compare these, look what's going on. The foolish virgins had something. They had the external, the lamp, without the internal, the oil. But the faithless servant had the internal, had the gold, which he just buried in a hole, instead of sending out in the world to do its work. The foolish virgins are not allowed in. But the servant is in, and now he is cast out. The foolish virgins are in the dark because they had no oil. But the faithless servant is in the dark because he had no works. Again, internal, external. The foolish virgins, this parable is all about the spiritual realm. The oil represents something spiritual. The faithless servant, it's about the physical. The virgins are destined for a wedding, but missed it. And the servant was destined for a reward, but he missed it. See how the two connect? Isn't it amazing? Again, the very first parable, who is the faithful and wise servant? Let me teach you what a wise person is and what a faithful person is. And then what a foolish and a wicked person is too. And so he gives us these two parables. These parables are about us, people who claim to know God, people who have his word, people who have been entrusted with a work to do in this world. And we must take our work very seriously. We must be constantly nurturing and feeding and building up and encouraging the people of the household of faith. Constantly, we have to be doing that work. And also, that's the feminine. And also going into the world and doing the work, working the works God has given us to do, obeying his commandments. We must be doing both, to be wise and to be faithful. But there's one more parable we have to finish up with. Chapter 25. Now, this is for the outsiders. And this is a parable you don't hear taught on too much. Verse 31. But when the Son of Man comes in his glory, this is a reference to Daniel chapter 7, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him. So these aren't the believers. These aren't the insiders. These are the outsiders. And he will separate them from one another as the shepherd separates sheep from goats. Now, if you know anything about sheep and goats, they can look kind of alike on the outside, but their natures are very different, completely different. You can see the Ramunis, they raise goats, they know about them, and Adam here knows goats. Sheep and goats, their inner natures are completely different. And he will put the sheep on his right. Right is the what? Spiritual. And the goats on the left. Left is what? The physical. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, you invited me in. Naked, you clothed me. I was sick, you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous. Now get this, they know nothing about God. Then the right, they're called righteous. The righteous will answer him, Lord, Master, when do we do this? We have no recollection of doing any of these things for you. And they go through verse 37, 38, 39. When do we do any of this? We're completely unaware of having done anything to deserve this blessing, to be welcomed into your kingdom. Verse 40, the king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. You know what I think is going on here? We often wonder, how about the people in third world countries and in the jungles and every place else who never hear the gospel? I think this parable is God saying to us, listen, if I know they at least have a heart that would have received the gospel had they heard it presented correctly, that's good enough. If they have the nature of a sheep, that's good enough. Because remember, I was in a conversation recently with an evangelical friend of mine, and he's talking about this and that, and about knowing Jesus, and, you know, we have to know him. I said, are we saved by what we know, or by what Jesus did? And he had to stop and think. We're saved by what he did. Now, if we know that and follow him and live for him, there are so many things we get saved from. We can be saved from all kinds of difficulties and troubles and issues and complications that we don't need. All kinds of things that we can get rescued from. In a recent email conversation with a lady where she talked about salvation. And as we were going through, every time she sees the word salvation, she was thinking salvation from hell, going to heaven, so going to hell. I had to say, stop a second. Quit thinking of salvation as being only going to heaven and not going to hell. When you look at the word saved all through Scripture, you see people saved from famine, saved from war, saved from sickness, saved from homelessness, saved from poverty, saved from this, saved from all kinds of troubles. The word salvation really means rescue, deliverance. God saves us from all kinds of things. So quit taking every time you find the word saved and put it in the hell and heaven category. Don't do that. He rescues us from all of our troubles. And I want people to know about him so their lives can be led in light and in truth and in understanding. But when it comes to heaven and hell and it comes to our destiny in the world to come, I think God's teaching here, if you at least had a heart that would have accepted Messiah, come on in, you righteous. Your nature is that of a sheep and not of a goat. Follow? You go on a little bit further. Then it'll say to those on the left, depart from me, you cursed ones, into age-lasting fire, which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. I was hungry, he gave me nothing to eat. And he goes through these things. And then verse 44, they say, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or stranger, naked or sick or in prison, did not take care of you? We have no recollection of ignoring you. Then he will answer them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did not do it to one of the least of these, you didn't do it to me. I'm going to close with this. I have so much more I would share with you, but that's just extra. But I want to close with this. There's a wonderful midrash. It's a midrash on the book of Psalms. And it's a commentary on Psalm 118, verses 19 and 20. Open to me the gates of righteousness. Now remember, in the parable, Yeshua, the judge, calls the sheep, verse 37, then the righteous will answer him, calls them righteous. And in Psalm 118, 19, 20, says, open to me the gates of righteousness, that I may enter through them and give thanks to Adonai. This is the gate of Adonai. The righteous shall enter through it. And this is the short little commentary. It says, in the future world, man will be asked, what was your occupation? If he replies, I fed the hungry, then they will reply, this is the gate of Adonai. He who feeds the hungry, let him enter. So with giving drink to the thirsty, clothing the naked, with those who look after the orphans, and those generally who do deeds of loving kindness. All these are gates of Adonai, and those who do such deeds shall enter within them. Now, I don't know which came first, that ancient midrash or Yeshua's words, but they're saying the same thing. Are we saved by works? No, we're saved by God. But some people have hearts that respond and others have hearts that don't. And if you just at least have a heart that would respond to truth, God says, that's all right. You can't help it you were never told. You can't help it you never heard. Come in, you righteous. Okay? Is that an excuse not to carry the gospel? Absolutely not. We're commanded to take the gospel because people should live with understanding, with truth. And there's so many things these righteous lambs could be set free from. There's so many victories they could have. There's so many things they could be saved from if they just had the word of truth. Could have the handbook that tells them how to live life. All right, well, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for this time, for the wonderful words of Messiah found in Matthew's Holy Gospel. I pray, Lord, that we would not make the error of walking away from here and thinking, oh, now I understand it. For, Lord, there's so much here. There's a lifetime's worth of wisdom and insight remains in these wonderful parables. So, Lord, I pray, forgive us of the sin of fear, of passivity, of laziness, of cockiness, of thinking we know you. Maybe we really don't. Help us to be humble and give us a wholesome fear of God and realize that you will come suddenly, whether it's in death or whether it's to establish your kingdom. In either case, we will stand before you. And I pray, Father, we will be like the wise virgins who go and become part of the bride. We'll be like the faithful servant who hears the words, well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of the Lord. You were faithful in a few things. Now I'll make you the owner and overseer of many things. So, Lord, I pray you would seek to be the bride you want us to be. Seek to be the servant that we need to be. And may we always look to Messiah for our example. Make us the people you want us to be, Father, we ask in Yeshua's name. Amen.